S, the Democrat-led Senate, but the Republican-majority House of Representatives refused to vote on it in a setback to President Joe Biden's war planning.
Let me be clear here again this morning. The Republican-led House will not be jammed or forced into passing a foreign aid bill that was opposed by most Republican senators and does nothing to secure our own border.
Earlier this month, Biden unsuccessfully tried to force through a $120 billion war spending bill, which even cynically tried to win over Republicans with $20 billion in anti-immigrant border security spending. While top polling agencies have remained mostly silent on the issue so far this year, the most recent polls confirm that public support has plummeted for more weapons to fuel foreign wars. There is an increasingly vocal desire to end American warmongering abroad and to focus money, energy, and attention on the raft of post-pandemic and post-great financial crisis domestic problems.
The situation here on the ground is definitely can be radicalizing because people are not even being provided with any of the usual concessions that imperial nations oftentimes, you know, give their citizens to keep them distracted. They're just being left out there while, again, we are giving billions and trillions to other countries to fight wars that are supposedly on our behalf, and yet we don't get to have any input in that.
The Biden administration has repeatedly rejected any negotiated settlement to the Ukraine conflict and has no strings attached to its unshakable support of Tel Aviv. Many say it's just a matter of time before more weapons are eventually sent to Israel and Ukraine, despite the global outcry.
We have to remember that these wars go on until America is defeated. Eventually, the public turns against every war. The war keeps going until it's no longer useful to big business, and it's no longer useful to defeating our rivals and corralling world energy resources.
The failed bill explicitly prohibited any funds for the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, which is the main humanitarian agency in Gaza. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
In Britain, the Interfaith Network has not received the £155,000 it had been offered. There is talk of closure for the charity as the British government withdraws its funding. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story. A charity that has worked for 37 years for greater cohesion between different UK faith communities is expected to close down next week after the government signalled it would scrap its funding. The Interfaith Network is due to close after Michael Gove, the community secretary, said he was minded to withdraw the £155,000 of provisional funding over concerns about a trustee connected to the Muslim Council of Britain. In a letter to the network's co-chairs on 19th of January, Michael Gove said, "It has come to my attention that a member of the Muslim Council of Britain has been appointed as a trustee of the Interfaith Network. Successive British governments have had a long-standing policy of non-engagement with the Muslim Council of Britain. The appointment of a Muslim Council of Britain trustee to the board of the Interfaith Network, a government-funded organisation, poses a reputation risk to the government. I'm therefore minded to withdraw the provisional offer of £155,000 of new funding for 2023-2024. Back in 2009, the then Labour government suspended cooperation with the Muslim Council of Britain after accusing its leaders at the time of supporting violence against the Israeli regime. The policy has been continued by conservative ministers despite a change of leadership at the month. The policy has been continued by conservative ministers despite a change of leadership at the Muslim Council of Britain. Hassan Joudi, a former Assistant Secretary General of the Muslim Council of Britain, was appointed as one of the 22 trustees of the Interfaith Network last July. The network said due diligence checks were made when appointing trustees. The Interfaith Network said it had never been told that the government funding was conditional on not having a trustee with links to the Muslim Council of Britain. The Interfaith Network has also never been advised to seek to expel the Muslim Council of Britain from membership on grounds such as the government's position of non-engagement, its co-chair said in their reply to Michael Gove's letter. They said that more than 500 national, regional and local Muslim organisations, mosques, charities and schools were members of the Muslim Council of Britain. Although the government can choose not to engage with it, that is not a sensible option open to the Interfaith Network if it is to achieve the purposes for which the government funds it in the first place. The Interfaith Network receives almost two-thirds of its annual funding from the government, with the rest coming from trusts, faith communities and individual donors. The network includes Christian, Muslim, Jewish, Sikh, Hindu, Buddhist, Jain, spiritualist and Zoroastrian organizations among its members. It strives to advance public knowledge and mutual understanding of the teachings, traditions and practices of different faith communities in Britain and to promote good relations between people of different faiths. The network said it could not continue to operate without government funding, despite other fundraising efforts. Narendra Wagela, one of the Interfaith Network's co-chairs, said it would be a very serious loss to the United Kingdom for the Interfaith Network to be forced into closure, particularly during these turbulent and difficult times, which throw into sharp relief the importance of work to encourage and support dialogue and cooperation between people of different religious faiths and to increase religious literacy and tackle prejudice. A spokesperson for the Muslim Council of Britain said, "At a time when communities in our country should come together, there is desperate need for independent initiatives such as the Interfaith Network, who for over 30 years have forged dialogue and cooperation between different faiths." Many will find it baffling that the British government would choose to do so much damage to interfaith relations as it pursues an ideologically vengeful campaign based on spurious grounds. The Department for Levelling Up Housing and Communities, which Michael Gove is in charge of, said all funded organisations were subject to due diligence processes. A spokesperson declined to comment on the funding for the Interfaith Network. Another British newspaper, the Church Times, has also covered this story and tells us more. A charity set up to promote interfaith dialogue is on the brink of closure after the Community Secretary Michael Gove said he was minded to withdraw its funding because of the reputational risk to the British government and because a member of the Muslim Council of Britain was one of the charity's trustees. The government does not engage with the Muslim Council of Britain after a former member appeared to condone attacks on the British Navy in 2009. The Interfaith Network said that it had not been asked to prescribe membership of any individual, nor had it previously been advised by the department to expel any Muslim Council of Britain members because the government's policy of non-engagement. The member in question is Hassan Judi, a former Assistant Secretary General of the Muslim Council of Britain. He was appointed as a trustee of the Interfaith Network in July of 2023. The charity said in a statement that its board had not sought Mr. Judy's resignation and affirmed his role as a valued colleague. Interfaith Network does not endorse the views of any of its member bodies, nor can any one member body, or indeed trustee, exert improper influence over the organisation. Interfaith Network's purpose is to promote understanding about different faiths and strengthen good interfaith relations. That is the basis on which it has always sought and been granted government funding. The charity had been offered £155,000 in new funding by the department for the period July 2023 to March of 2024, and access to a £45,000 underspend from the previous year's funding, but the money has not been handed over. The resulting shortfall means that its four members of staff have been given notice of redundancy. The charity's board is to meet again next week to confirm its closure unless money owed by the government is made available. An Interfaith Network co-chair, Canon Hilary Barber, said, "The Interfaith Network for the United Kingdom has worked for over three decades with churches and with other faiths to increase understanding and cooperation in Britain in ways which are rooted in shared values and which respect the integrity of the different faith communities. Its vital work will be lost unless a way forward is found and funding in the coming days." The trustees of Interfaith Network have explored many other funding possibilities, but support from the British government remains vital. "We hope that government will reconfirm its funding offer of last July and release the urgently needed resources to enable Interfaith Network's work to continue, including National Interfaith Week to continue." A petition has been created on the website change.org urging the Minister, Michael Gove, to maintain funding. MPs, including Sir Stephen Timms, who chairs the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Faith and Society, are lobbying the government over funding. The Interfaith Network has worked since 1987 to advance public knowledge and mutual understanding of the teachings, traditions and practices of the different faith communities in Britain. Its board includes people of the largest faith groups in Britain.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Hidden Files. Do you condemn Hamas? This has been mainstream media's favorite question ever since Hamas's preemptive strike on occupied Palestine on October the 7th. But sadly for them, they're no longer the only media that people get their news from. After some 75 years of the ongoing genocide in Palestine, the journalists on the ground were finally able to get their voice across to people all over the world and to inform them of the bombings that have killed tens of thousands of Palestinians, mostly women and children. And that's when October 7th could no longer justify the ongoing genocide, even in the minds of former supporters of the Israeli regime. Now, many have already realized that mainstream media blamed Hamas to buy more time for the Zionist regime to murder as many Palestinians as they could and to occupy as much land as possible. But the question remains, from a legal perspective, who is responsible for the thousands of lives lost, especially since October the 7th? Hello, I'm Marzieh Hashemi, and this is Hidden Files. This is the discussion that we will have today with lawyer and doctor of jurisprudence and human rights activist Stanley Cohen. Stay tuned, please.
Stanley Cohen is an American lawyer and human rights activist. Following graduation from college, Stanley started working as a VISTA volunteer and helped set up legal service projects in Native American reservations. Cohen then went on to work as a community organizer to tackle the issues of homeless teens and later as an administrator in a federally funded anti-poverty agency. He then went on to law school to defend human rights on a legal level and earned a doctorate of jurisprudence. Since then, he has worked on various lawsuits, from those taking on the NSA spying program to others involving false accusations targeting various minorities and individuals. Defending Patrice Lumumba against accusations of the material support of terrorism, and defending the Hamas political leader against extradition by the Israeli regime. Due to his success in various such legal projects, Stanley Cohen has for long been a target for smearing campaigns and various threats, which he has survived to date.
Well, thank you so much, Stanley Cohen, for being with us. I'd like to start off with mainstream media's favorite question. Do you condemn Hamas? And what are the legal definitions of their actions according to law?
I like to respond to that question with, who did you pick on before Hamas from 1936 to 1985? The mainstream media likes to use Hamas as the convenient boogeyman, likes to use any quote-unquote Islamist movement, even one that's overseeing, with all the difficulties, the civil society that was voted into office. But it's always Hamas, Hamas, Hamas. So they look to October 7th, and they completely ignore the history of Israeli genocide, Israeli ethnic cleansing, Israeli war crimes, Israeli crimes against humanity, and they say it's Hamas. Do I condemn Hamas? No. Hamas is a national liberation movement that has been in the forefront of the resistance since 1985. It has a leadership that is highly educated, sophisticated, learned, committed to their people from Gaza. These are not people that one day got on a plane and came from Brooklyn, as the Zionists are, to some foreign country. These are people that grew up in Gaza, many of whom the leadership left over a number of years to pursue education elsewhere, received doctorate degrees. They're academics, they're scholars, they're lawyers, they're scientists, they're producers, they're directors, they're artists, and return home to help to liberate Palestine. So do I condemn Hamas? No.
Well, let's talk a little bit about you, because you've represented many people who couldn't afford to pay you along the way. And I mean, given your expertise and your experience, you could have had a lot more money. Why did you choose a different path?
I recently had a discussion with a journalist who asked me the same question. I said, well, I'm sure Henry Kissinger did not get to take his money with him. I'm sure Bill Gates will not be able to take his money with him. We have to make choices in life. Is it about the pursuit of profit? Is it about the pursuit of power? Is it about political control? Or is it about being part of a world community that's here for a very limited period of time? Since that they too were not going to spend their lives pursuing money, but pursuing justice.
Well, why did you, you've decided to represent a lot of Hamas officials and other groups too, although there would be repercussions for you. Why is that the case?
Well, I had, years before I represented Abu Marzouk, who was one of the founders of Hamas and was the original head of the political wing and is now still a major senior leader of the movement, I had been involved in supporting Palestinian self-determination, Palestinian independence, Palestinian liberation as a young lawyer. I organized some political actions. I was involved as an attorney representing people that were protesting against Israel years before even Hamas evolved. I had a very active role in a Muslim in the Islamic community in the United States, not trying to singularize it, because obviously it's a community of diversity with different priorities. In fact, through my work representing many dozens of Albanian Muslims who were charged with various situations in the United States and who eventually, as a result of negotiations, went to Bosnia and joined the KLA with the approval of the United States, in essence fighting before the United States dragged NATO in, before the bombings occurred. That connected me in a different light to the Muslim community in the United States in general and to the Palestinian community in particular. And then one day when I had just finished a very long trial and was getting ready to go on holiday for a few weeks, I got a call from the leaders of one of these organizations who asked me if I could go to the federal prison, that there was a gentleman who had been picked up suddenly on an immigration hold, someone who was a lawful resident in the United States. And I really was too tired and I couldn't do it. And I recommended other lawyers. And then as an aside, I said, well, who is this person? And then he mentioned a name to me, and the name didn't mean anything to me at the time. And he said, Musa Abu Marzouk. And I said, who was that? And then he said, well, I said, no, I'm tired. I need to get away. I've got family and friends that are expecting me. We've got a cabin on the ocean. And then he said, well, he's the head of Hamas. And I went, oh, okay. So I called my family and I said, look, you're going to have to do what you have to do on your own. I've got to go see this gentleman. And I went to meet Abu Marzouk. We spent a day or half a day talking. And I'll never forget, he looked at me when I walked in and he said, looked up and down at me, up and down. I had, my hair was all over the place and I had ripped dungarees on and I had a sweatshirt on that said, the first thing we do, quoting Shakespeare, we'll kill all the lawyers. And he looked at me and he said, who are you? And I told him, I used a certain term that I'd, a phrase that I'd been told to use to give him comfort, that I wasn't there as a representative of the government. I'd been sent friends. And I used it. And he said, well, who are you? As he stared at me up and down, amazed, and he looked at me. And I said, well, I'm a lawyer. And he looked at me up and down. And he said, you're a lawyer? He said, I don't need a lawyer. And I said, you're right. You don't need one lawyer. You need a dozen lawyers. And he laughed. And he said, sit down. And I did. And that was the beginning of probably 1,000 hours worth of one-on-one discussions that he and I had over the next 2 years. While we fought his case initially, it was for a removal order from the United States. And then the Knesset, an unprecedented act, issued an arrest warrant and demanded his extradition to Israel to stand trial for the Intifada. We became very close over the course of 2 years. And Abu Marzouk is not just a founder, a framer, and the original head of the political wing of Hamas. He's a brilliant political scientist. He's a brilliant internationalist. He's a travel gentleman who has, and still does, obviously, tremendous experience in politics and reality and history. He understands.
Wow, it's quite interesting, quite beautiful. I want to look at, if you give me permission, ask you a question about your Twitter account or X, because you have a profile picture of two Hamas leaders there. I'd like to know why you have chosen that picture for your profile picture.
Sheikh Ahmed was a friend. I had the privilege and the pleasure of spending time with him, being hosted by him in Gaza on five or six occasions before he was assassinated. Abu Shanab was a dear friend. I spent a lot of time with Abu Shanab. In fact, the car in which he was assassinated was by an Israeli rocket. I had been in that car just 4 or 5 days before he had been murdered, going to an interview to show you the kindness, the support, the love of the Palestinian community in general in my relationship with it. I had left Gaza. I was handling a case in California. It was early in the morning. I was asleep and my phone rang. And it was Abu Shanab's wife who told me she was giving me her condolences. She told me that Abu Shanab had been assassinated several hours before, and she wanted to give her condolences to me, his wife of decades, the mother of his children, because she knew how close we were. We were very close. Whenever I would go to Gaza, I would spend hours and days with Abu Shanab. He'd be my escort. He was a professor of engineering at the Islamic University in Gaza. He was educated, got his PhD in the United States. He was very close friends with Abu Marzouk. We hit it off right away. And I could think of no better way of honoring the memory of these two great warriors, these two wonderful, dynamic, principled fighters for justice and human rights.
Well, there are those who talk about Hamas on October the 7th and the legality as we are in the middle of this Israeli genocide. I mean, I'd like to hear your perspective based on international law regarding both sides of this current situation.
Under international law, an occupying force, an occupying state is permitted to maintain the de minimis or the minimum amount of security apparatus until there's a resolution as to the occupation. And that may mean small military outposts. That may mean the presence of occupying military or security forces. It does not permit the introduction of, as they have here, some 800,000 largely European colonialist Jews into the West Bank. It does not permit the theft of land and the establishment of so-called settlements. It does not permit for the building of walls. It does not permit for the establishment of infrastructure, of economy, of an infrastructure, a system that is comparable basically to a city. It doesn't permit it. And what they do, Israel, again, in going one step further, they decided because it's quote-unquote a military zone, then people that have been in the military zone for for thousands of years, are not entitled to due process of the occupying state. They're not entitled to get access to Israeli courts. And as we've seen for years now, even those Israelis going through the Israeli court system are denied any real modicum of justice, due process, and equal protection with a system of government in which the Knesset can largely overrule what the court system wants to do. So what they've done is they've established this military system. It's staffed by military judges, by military security people out of uniform are not civilians. Israeli police out of uniform are not civilians. Settlers that are carrying weapons are not civilians. Settler outposts that have heavy-duty weapons is not a civilian outpost. So there's that whole definition. But clearly, children, the elderly, the infirm are civilian under international law and should not be removed. But the problem that we is not knowing who did what, when, where, why, or how, with just competing narratives. But when we talk about competing narratives, there's no debate over what's going on in Gaza. There's no debate what's been going on in Palestine for 75, 80, 85 years, even before the United Nations crafted Israel. Response to that is, Israel proved your case. The International Criminal Court ruled in 2021 that it has jurisdiction not just over Palestine because it's a signatory to the Rome Statute.
Well, I can't believe we're still watching this murder take place on a daily basis. What can be done to stop this genocide immediately, in your perspective?
The ICC has enough probable cause and has enough evidence to issue arrest warrants for Netanyahu and a dozen of his top advisors. That immediately limits their ability to travel. That immediately sends a message to people that want to come there to meet with them, conspire with them. That raises the accountability and the concern because that really sends the message, okay, you are a suspected criminal. There is an arrest warrant for you. We're going to file it with Interpol. There is some standing for the notion that assets can be frozen, which Iran is well versed in, although it's been used not legally against Iran over the years, but as a political weapon. Assets can be frozen. Organizations, private entities that are now providing money, that are now providing weapons, that are now providing technical support to the Israeli government are on notice that if you continue, you may yourselves be involved in criminal wrongdoing. The General Assembly can ask the ICJ for an immediate recommendation. There is universal jurisdiction in many countries in this world. Claims can be brought. They've been started already in South Africa, which is similar to the ICC to the extent that they have the power to issue arrest warrants based upon probable cause. Red notices are set with Interpol. In states themselves, for example, in the United States, there can be an effort, there should be, lobbying and political effort to impose the Arms Export Control Act, which will freeze funding and weapons for Israel. There are domestic jurisdiction issues where if I'm a Palestinian and I have Palestinian-American or Palestinian who happens to be in the United States right now, who has family, businesses, homes, etc., that have been destroyed, who have been executed, that have been victimized by war crimes, they can attempt to bring domestic actions in domestic courts under U.S. law. There's an issue of what's called extraterritoriality, which has to do with the ability of U.S. courts to reach out for activity and conduct overseas directed at U.S. But keep in mind, the U.S. has had more than a few examples over the years of Palestinian American citizens, including famed journalists, that have been executed by Israel, and the Department of Justice has done nothing in the United States. So again, there's that double standard. So there is an ability to move the ICC to bring an advisory opinion action, the International Court of Jurisdiction of Justice, for universal jurisdictions to file arrest warrants for Netanyahu and other leaders of the military, to begin to identify businesses. And we know there have been lawsuits in the United States that have gone after tax-exempt organizations that provide money illegally that are tax-exempt to so-called settlements in the occupied West Bank and the Palestinian territories. So there is a combination of actions which can be brought domestically and internationally, which can be saying to Israel enough. But at this point, there have been 20,000 Palestinians who have lost their lives, almost all of them civilians, 60% of them children. 75% of Gaza is in ruins. 1.5 million people have been displaced. No food, no water, no electricity, no medical attention. Who knows what viruses and illnesses and plagues are going to befall. But again, this is not inadvertent. This is a determined effort, a designed plan that Israel has been waiting to unleash, and it has.
Yeah, it's absolutely unbelievable, mind-boggling what is taking place and how everyone is watching it. I mean, based on this international rules-based community that exists right now, do you think that this same community then will actually play a role in stopping this genocide?
I'm not waiting for the world community to all of a sudden grow principle and justice and independence and to move on behalf of a targeted people. If for that, you know, we will be generations away. But I am optimistic that the combination of movement at the ICC, movement at universal jurisdictions, but most important, millions of young, largely young women and men worldwide in the streets, demonstrating, the BDS movement expanding, Israeli military factories and plants that are providing information being demonstrated against, civil disobedience there. There have been acts of criminal mischief as well. So I think this combination, and keep in mind, I'm not naive. I don't believe that Biden or the West or anyone is going to step in until after Israel has been able to accomplish the next step of its never-ending Nakba that it's designed to do. But I think they're reaching, and they're not going to step in out of principle or out of purpose or out of passion or out of love or out of humanity. But it's going to reach a point where politically it's boomeranging back against them, and that's when they're going to step in. But meanwhile, the fact that Netanyahu has been given a green light, I mean, now he's invading the South. They displaced 1.5 million people in the north and the center of Gaza and sent them down basically to the south. And now the tanks are rolling into the south. And there's no defense. And there's hundreds, if not thousands, of Palestinian civilians, again, being slaughtered every day. There are variables. And I'm not suggesting or proposing that Hezbollah or Syria or anyone else continue their involvement or expand it. But that's an issue. Using the old anecdote, the colloquialism, the 800-pound gorilla in the China shop, there's increasing tension and fighting going on with Hezbollah in the north. Syria is pushing back again. I suspect the West Bank is going to explode. The real issue is, I think there's going to come a point in time. Let us not forget, this is as much about Netanyahu trying to save himself from a judicial process that he's under indictment, I believe, in 2 or 3 cases, and the trials are beginning again. In Netanyahu's mind, as long as he can say we're at war, we're at war, we're at war, we're at war, he's safe. In the minds of the Kahanists that now run the military, the industrial military complex, the security state, as long as they get to say, see what they did to us, us, they're allowed to expand, they're allowed to justify increasing violence, expansion of so-called settlements. I don't know how it's going to play out at this point. One thing is for sure, that resolution, meanwhile, is thousands of Palestinian lives are being lost to the lust, the political lust, not just of Israel, but the proxy masters of the West that have been involved in this situation. And it's not just the West. I look at UAE, I look at Bahrain, I look at Saudi Arabia, I look at Morocco, I look at other Arab states or Gulf states that have been complicit throughout. I look at the fact that we had to beg Egypt to open Rafah even periodically for goods and services to come in. And meanwhile says, yes, we'll let Rafah should be open so that we can displace 1 million Palestinians. Egypt, new deal. Push them off into the Sinai. Let's send the Bedouin back to the desert. So we have complicity among certain states in the region. And then we have other states that have long supported Palestine. Iran is one. Doha, Qatar has been there. Algeria has been there. South Africa and African states have been there. So we've got this tension that's underway right now, and I'd like to be able to predict with some modicum of certainty how it's going to end up, but I really can't at this point.
Well, Stanley, I'd like to hear your final comments about the overall situation.
Is very clear on what's going on in Palestine. I think the world community, especially the young women and men of the world community, need to stay in the streets, need to demonstrate, need to engage in all sorts of activities against governments, need to make sure that the political leadership understand there's a price to pay for their blind, obedient support for Israeli genocide. I send my love and solidarity to the Palestinian people. They know they are loved. They know they have support. We will fight with them. We will work with them. We will struggle with them. We will never forget we are family.
Stanley Cohen, it's been a pleasure having you right here on Hidden Files. I'd like to welcome my colleague, Maryam Azadcher, to Hidden Files. She's going to bring us a little bit more information about other situations taking place since October the 7th. Well, Maryam, welcome to the Hidden Files team. It's a pleasure having you on board.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure being part of this team.
Well, I'd like to look at, because outside of the Palestinian territories, there were other situations taking place that has had a big effect. Tell us about that.
Yes, of course. So now what happened is that in bombing Gaza indiscriminately, the Israeli regime didn't just destroy Palestinian homes, schools, and hospitals. It also destroyed the widely believed myth that the international law was created to defend the rights of oppressed nations, and therefore there's no need for armed resistance. Now, today, this law has no real legitimacy and power in the eyes of millions who have seen Palestinian parents pull out the bodies of their children from under the rubble in the deafening silence of the so-called international community.
It's often said that one man's terrorist is another's freedom fighter. Well, in this case, one colonialist's terrorist is a nation's resistance fighter, and this has held true throughout history, where indigenous peoples, like Palestinians, were invaded using lethal weapons, stripped of their lands, using legal weapons and documents, and portrayed as the perpetrators of using the weapon of media. But there's one thing these powers cannot win without your consent, and that is the control of your mind. So next time they ask you to condemn those fighting against colonial interests, maybe let them know that you have read their history. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us on this Hidden Files. It's time.
اقرأ باسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا.
قد دعوتك ربي بقرآنك جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفرانك يا من ينجينا إحسان. ودعوتك ربي بقرآنك.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم.
السلام عليكم respected brothers and sisters all over the world listening to IRB English Radio. Welcome to Let's Recite the Quran Kareem, a series of Quranic sessions held by IRB English Radio in cooperation with Sevier International Schools Network. I welcome you, brothers and sisters, dear listeners, among our brothers here, dear Ali Nasser, Hussein Ruhullah, and Hassan Nasrullah. Assalamu alaikum, and welcome everyone.
Wa alaikum assalam, sir. How are you?
Alhamdulillah. Ali Nasser, how is it going?
Alhamdulillah, sir.
All right. And Hassan?
Alhamdulillah, sir.
All right. So, everyone is fine. Hope you are doing well. Dear listeners, let's get started. Inshallah, today we'll talk about ayah 21 and
22.
Surah
Al-A'raf.
What page?
152.
Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, turn to page 152, Surah Al-A'raf, ayah 21 and 22. We will continue the story of Adam alayhi salam, the creation, and he was in the heaven, how he was tempted by Shaitan, by Iblis, yeah? And the rest of the story, all right?
Yes.
Hassan, Hussein, Ali Nasir, ready to listen to the recitation? Huh?
Yes.
Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, join us. Let's listen to the recitation of this ayah.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. وقاسمهما إني لكما لمن الناصحين فدلاهما بغرور فلما ذاق الشجرة بدت لهما سوآتهما وطفقا يخصفان عليهما من ورق الجنة وناداهما ربهما ألم أنهكما عن تلكما الشجرة وأقل لكما إن الشيطان لكما عدو مبين.
Nice recitation, mashallah. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. وقاسمهما إني لكما لمن الناصحين. Hassan, could you read this for us once, this ayah? Then we'll move on to the next ayah.
Yes.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
وقاسمهما إني لكما لمن الناصحين.
أحسنت. فدلاهما.
فدلاهما بغرور.
أحسنت.
فلما ذاق الشجرة بدت لهما سوآتهما وتفقا يخصفان عليهما من ورق الجنة.
أحسنت.
وناداهما ربهما ألم أنهكما عن تلكما الشجرة وأقل لكما إن الشيطان لكما عدو مبين.
الله أكبر. أحسنت. ما شاء الله. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. وانقاسمهما says what? Since Shaitan was a sworn enemy of Allah. Adam alayhi salam, okay, he was doing everything to
mislead
Adam. Yes, Hassan?
Yes.
And did he try his best or no?
Yes, he's trying also.
And he says, وَقَاسَمَهُمَا. And he swore to them. Okay? He swore to them. إِنِّي لَكُمَا لَمِنَ النَّاصِحِينَ. I'm indeed your well-wisher. Okay? I'm wishing good things for you. Come on, you gotta listen to me. Look, Allah does not want you to be like angels. Allah does not want you to be everlasting. That's why He says, don't approach that tree. In the next ayah, فَدَلَّاهُمَا. Okay, let's once talk about the tajweed rules of this ayah. فَوَقَاسَمَهُمَا. قَا has a
heavy
letter. It's a heavy letter, so you gotta pronounce it. Heavily. How do you pronounce Hassan? Qa. Qasamahuma. How?
Qasamahuma.
Yeah. Qasamahuma. And, sorry. Inni. Inni. Huh? Next one. Lakuma laminan.
Nasihin.
That's all. Ha, sad. Pronounce them correctly. Next ayah. Fadallahuma bighurur. Thus, he brought about their fall by deception. They kind of, Shaitan, okay, kind of tempted them, and فَلَمَّ ذَاقَ الشَّجَرَةَ. So when they tested of the tree, okay, Adam and Eve alayhim as-salam, بَدَتْ لَهُمَا سَوْآتُهُمَا, their nakedness became exposed to them. And then their Lord, Allah Almighty, called them. وَنَادَاهُمَا رَبُّهُمَا, their Lord called out to them. Did I not forbid you from that tree? I said, don't approach that tree. Okay? You're going to be wrongdoers. Sometimes Allah wants us to. Yeah?
Yeah.
We must obey Him.
Obey Him.
Like, for example, Allah Almighty says, don't eat pork. Pork is haram for you to eat. Okay? Pork is
haram
for you to eat.
Forbid.
This is one type of commitment, okay? This is called Nahi Mawlawi, and Fiqh and Usul, you will learn this, okay, in Islamic studies. And we have also Irshadi one, which means the guidance. Allah shows that, don't do this, it might be harmful for you, okay? Don't do it, don't approach this tree, for example. This could be one of these type, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You can refer to the Tafasir books. Now, وَطَفِقَا يَخْسِفَانَ عَلَيْهِمَا مِنْ وَرَقِ الْجَنَّةِ وَنَادَاهُمَا رَبُّهُمَا أَلَمْ أَنْهَكُمَا عَنْ تِلْكُمَا الشَّجَرَةِ وَأَقُلْ لَكُمَا إِنَّ الشَّيْطَانَ لَكُمَا عَدُوٌ مُبِينٌ. Allah Almighty wanted to teach Adam alayhi salam that, hey, listen, Adam has sworn by me. فَبِعِزَّتِكَ. In another verses we have, Shaitan said to Allah Almighty that, فَبِعِزَّتِكَ لَأُغْوِيَنَّهُمْ أَجْمَعِينَ. That I swear by your izzah, by your dignity, by your power, okay? By you, O God, that I will mislead all your worshippers.
Yes.
Okay, human beings. So Allah says, أَلَمْ أَنْهَكُمَا عَنْ تِلْكُمَا الشَّجَرَةَ وَأَقُلْ لَكُمَا إِنَّ الشَّيْطَانَ لَكُمَا عَدُوٌ مُبِينٌ. Shaitan is your clear, your manifest enemy. Allah Almighty wanted to teach Adam alayhi salam to be careful. Alright?
Yes.
قرآني نبض حياتي قرآني طهر ذاتي قرآني عصمة أمري قرآني طوق نجاتي قرآني نبض حياتي.
How to learn Quran easy? What is the correct way to read the Quran?
What is the correct way to learn Arabic and understand the Quran? Be with Let's recite the Quran.
So, فَدَلَّاهُمَا, make sure you pronounce the alif there, بِغُرُور. Hassan tells us about that baby jim on the top, and later on we have صِلَة also. Hassan, could you tell us these two?
Yes. These two are stopping signs that jim tells us that it's optional to you to continue or to stop. And Sila tells you to continue. Continuing is better, but still you can stop.
You can make a pause.
Yes.
All right. فَلَمَّا ذَاقَ الشَّجَرَ ذَاقَ الشَّجَرَ. Do you ignore the alif or no?
Yeah.
ذَاقَ
الشَّجَرَ.
بَدَتْ لَهُمَا سَوْآتُهُمَا. Alif? There is an alif with the hamza.
Yes.
وَطَافِقَا. To heavy letters. Yakh, heavy letter. Sifani alayhima
min.
Min?
Plus waw.
What do you do?
Idgham.
Yes.
How?
It will become min waraq.
Miwaraqil jann.
With nasal sound.
Nasal sound. Wa nadahuma a. This sign, this sound. A. Not all or any other way, yeah. Okay? All are light sounds. Wanadahuma rabbuhuma alam an hakuma an
hakuma
tilkuma shajarati an tilkuma shajarati wa aqul lakuma إن الشيطان إن
نون مشدد.
We should.
Yes.
Nasal sound and
extended.
Extended.
إن الشيطان طا هبلر لكما عدو مبين. How do you read it, Hassan? عدو مبين.
عدو مبين.
عدو مبين. Thank you. That's all the tajweed rules and the short tafsir points. Make sure you refer to the tafasir books, inshallah, to learn more. We will do the recitation of this ayah, and that will be all from us for today. Ready, guys?
Yes. Yes.
Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, join us for a recitation. A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
وقاسمهما إني لكما لمن الناصحين
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 فدلاهما بغرور
فدلاهما بغرور
فلما ذاق الشجرة بدت لهما سوآتهما وطفقا يخصفان عليهما من ورق الجنة
فلما ذاق الشجرة بدت لهما سوآتهما وطفقا يخصفان عليهما من ورق الجنة
وناداهما ربهما ألم أنهكما عن تلكما الشجرة وأقل لكما
وناداهما ربهما ألم أنهكما عن تلكما الشجرة وأقل لكما إن الشيطان لكما عدو مبين وأقل لكما إن الشيطان لكما عدو مبين صدق الله العلي العظيم
صدق الله العلي العظيم
Ahsanta, mashallah. Thank you so much. Allah bless you, dear brothers and sisters, dear listeners. Thank you so much for being with IRB English Radio. Stay with us in the coming sessions. Inshallah, we'll continue our discussions. That's all from us for today. Thanks to IRB English Radio, Sevier International Schools Network, Brother Hassan Nasrullah, Hussein Rahullah, and Ali Nasir. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammadin wa alihi al-tahirin.
Allahumma. صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم
Let's recite the Quran. A joint production of IRIB English Radio and Sevier International Schools.
ذكر وموعظة ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن
IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.